A spiritual reminder from the streets of New York City. Come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, I will give you rest. Just remember, no parking, 24 hours active driveway. Vehicles will be towed at vehicle owner's expense.
Welcome once again to the Letterman Podcast. My name is Mike Chisholm, and I am so happy that we're bringing Steve Young back. Steve, legendary writer for Late Night and Late Show with David Letterman, still speaks in the voice of the show. It's surreal hanging out with Steve. We've become friends since this endeavor began, and I can't tell you how grateful I am for that friendship. And Steve is just such a when you speak with Steve, he speaks in the voice of Late Show with David Letterman. He just does, like, the things that he says, the way he reacts to things. It is surreal talking to this guy, but it's also so much fun. This episode here, I wanted to talk. We talked Letterman. Don't get me wrong. There's definitely Letterman stuff that we talk about. We talk about his return to the Ed Sullivan Theater when we went and saw Rupert's retirement. He was there that night, of course, and we spent time together. We've talked about that on a previous episode. His reaction there, talking about other things too, genesis of certain bits, and really, we actually get into some of the sensibilities of writing comedy for Late Show. He does a great comparison with a Letterman sensibility versus a Conan sensibility, and it's really neat. They're kind of the exact opposite of each other, actually, and it's neat talking about that. But we also spend time talking about the thing that Steve is doing right now, and the thing he's doing right now is writing comedy music, and he's doing it in two forms. He's doing it long form, and that, you know, it hasn't really been released. There's a couple things on his website, steveyoungworld.com, and his YouTube and whatnot, not really populating the long form stuff yet, but he's got some stuff in the can, as they say. But also, he's releasing these very short, TikTok-esque, he's actually even on TikTok now, type videos, YouTube short, perfect for YouTube shorts and things like that. 30-second videos of just little song jokes is really very well-produced, well-written, clever song jokes. And it's so much fun. We're going to pepper the episode with some of them as well. And just so happy that he has come back on here and just talking about what he's doing currently. Obviously, we talked about Bathtubs Over Broadway and as well, and how that has taken a life of its own. And all these things are kind of converging for him, which I really, all the folks who worked so many years for Late Night and Late Show that are still out there busting it, that are still out there working, these creatives, he talks about his creative process and we just have a really nice conversation. It's so much fun just catching up with him, and just appreciate Steve so much. The Letterman Podcast is one sponsor only. That is hello-deli.com. Don't forget the dash, because you won't go to the Hello Deli. You won't go to the site that sells Late Show with David Letterman merchandise, like mugs, like shirts, all sorts of great things by Rupert, sold, packaged, and sent lovingly and professionally by our good friend Rupert G, former owner of the Hello Deli, hello-deli.com. Head on over there. In the meantime, thank you very much for all the support. Please like, share, subscribe, all that crap. Please jump on to the, if you want to interact with the show, the best place to do it right now, because I am inept, is a Facebook group. I know, I'm a dinosaur. It's okay. It's all right. You're allowed to be a dinosaur. It's all right. My favorite dinosaur is a Stegosaurus. Which one's yours? Come on over to the Facebook group, the Letterman Podcast Facebook group. Interact with us. You want to throw questions up for a future guest, that kind of a thing, ideas, all this sort of stuff. We'd appreciate having you there and letting your voice be known. So, without further ado, we would love to present the return of Steve Young. Click. How are you, my friend? It's really good all to right. See you.
Yeah, always a pleasure.
Yeah.
And you've been talking to lots of interesting people, and you probably know much more about the show at this point than I do.
Oh, I certainly wouldn't go that far. The interesting people part is certainly Certainly true. Before I get to the interesting people, I want to start with one. We just finished with Jeremy Weiner, and he just opened up a time capsule of sorts, a cardboard one anyway, that has stood the test of time. And I want to talk to you a little bit about some of the things that came out of that box for a second. But okay, before I do, there's a piece of business that I need to address. And I mean, I'm not the guy that likes to air dirty laundry on this show, but there's a gal by the name of Irene Hoffman, who is the significant other, the gal pal of Rupert G. And she has expressed her unadulterated, unfiltered love for you and adoration for you. And when she found out we were doing this again today, she told me that Rupert is well aware that you certainly have the capability to steal her away from him. She loves you so much. And she told me to tell you hi and how much she appreciates you so much. So Irene says hi. I feel awkward now doing this. You know, sorry, Rupert, love you. But, you know, I don't know what you've captured.
You
captured
a juicy scandal that would get us a lot of ink in the tabloids. Maybe there's something to that.
She, like so many of us, love your mind, appreciate the things that come out of it, the interesting way that you view life and the observances you pull from that. Talking to Jeremy and opening this thing up, he produced a menu from a restaurant that you all used to frequent, Burger Heaven. Does that sound
right? That sounds right. I believe I know what this is and that it was actually... yes, marked up by all of the writers as if it were a script, and all sorts of head writer objections and rewrites and production notes were going on. I remember that very fondly. In fact, I believe Lee and Jeremy reproduced it at one point on a t-shirt.
Fantastic. He found the original. And I believe he's going to, when he saw that, you just saw the kind of the smile on his face. Another thing that he produced out of the box was, and it was so cool, Steve, seeing it. I've had this experience with you before when you've kind of opened up your box and shown me some of the things that you've kept. This, I think you'll get a kick out of this because it was something that he did. He said he came in early one day, and it was during the election cycle, probably in 2012. And he opened up this piece of paper, and you could see there was colors there, red and blue colors. And he opened it up, and he just got this little smile on his face because he immediately remembered the context of it, similar to what you just did with that menu. And it was a map of the United States drawn electorally. And if the election went in a certain way, you know, for example, if it went Republican in a certain way, you could spell the word ass in red on the map. Uh-huh. It was just watching his realization of seeing what it was again. It was such a neat little moment. And that's a great episode. And it felt very similar to that day when I was at your place going through the box of stuff that bring that brought up memories out of the nooks and crannies back into the forefront.
Yeah. We're at the point, I think, all of us who worked on the show, it's coming up on 9 years since it ended. And for many veterans like me, it was decades leading up to that end point. Memories get telescoped and compressed now to the point where I have the impression that I remember a fair amount of stuff about the show, but I may not. I may only remember like the few towering mountain peaks that come up above the plain, and the vast plain of 25 years or so is going to be more and more a mystery to me.
Absolutely. And which makes you know, the importance, or at least the self-importance of this show, of what we're doing here, even that much stronger, because this is what we want to do, is we want to keep these memories intact and be a record for them. There were two of your Christmas gifts, by the way, that came out of that box. Number okay. One is one that you and I have gone through, and you have given me so many laughs about, was the Chiron quiz A and B's. That came through. And I mean, you know, fantastic. I have it in a document form, thanks to you. And that was neat sharing that. But something else, early on, I think it was 03, you got the staff a calendar of basically just boring around the office pictures of around the Ed Sullivan Theater office building or the workplace, a 12-month calendar of just things in the office. Like, here's the photocopier. Here's a stairwell. Here's and it was just, it was so funny, the premise. But I'll tell you something that happened. He got to the writer's table and he looked at it and he got this nostalgic, like, oh, like I miss that place. And, uh-huh. and it literally is the gift that keeps on giving. Cause you know, 20 years later, whatever it is, he looks at that place that you guys went to and as originally intended as a joke, just a boring part of the workplace, much like the show, The Office, something, you know, celebrating the ordinary things in life. And anyway, that was, I got a real kick out of seeing that. That was a very Steve Young gift.
I had completely forgotten about that. As soon as you mentioned it, I had a foggy memory of it. And I definitely don't have one of those.
Oh, well, there we go. So, well, at least you'll be able to watch it. And maybe the digital files are somewhere else. I don't know. Maybe they're on one of the CDs you guys kept. But it's so neat seeing what made an impression on you all who worked there and what you kept, and then viewing it through this lens. Another thing that we talked about, I don't know if you remember this or not, this is a rabbit hole that I want to start. I think I want to take this show down this path to see if there's something that we can do. Do you have any recollections of Late Show the movie?
Late Show the movie. I'm not quite sure what that is.
Okay, so he said it was Tommy's, like Tommy was helming it, he said, but basically that the premise, that the way Jeremy kind of it's something that never aired, it's something that was worked on for a long time.
Oh, just... yeah, I faintly remember.
Okay,
a lot of things being shot for it and somehow it just never went.
Yeah, like you have this gift, kind of like Celebrigum. You have this opportunity where every day there's an A-lister coming in, and if they were game for it, they could shoot something for Late Show the movie, whatever it is, whether it's something scripted or whatever, they could be a part of it. And I guess all this footage was just getting amassed and it was kind of taking shape, but it became so, I don't know what the word is. I want to talk to Tommy about it. But anyway, so that was when that came up, I thought, okay, this might be a little rabbit hole we could go down. All this A-list celebrity footage that's somewhere, that's on a hard drive somewhere. It'd be kind of neat to explore that.
Yeah, but anyway. I started a similar project once that didn't get very far. I was trying to do a song called Backstage at the Late Show and trying to get a bunch of celebrities coming in to like sing a verse. And I think I got a couple people to do something. I definitely have a memory of playing guitar and Sting and I were singing Backstage at the Late Show. I don't remember exactly how it ended up. That footage may exist somewhere. I don't have it.
Yeah. And I mean, this is where we miss our boy Shecky so much. You know, that was, he was the official gatekeeper of a lot of that stuff. And the hard drives are around and whatnot. It would be really cool if we could figure out a way for someone who is a pantser or becomes a pantser or something like that, could go through some of this stuff. And maybe some of these things can be given a, I don't even know if there's rights issues for that. Like, okay, so say we find the footage of you and Sting, and we wanted to throw a clip of that on, say, a YouTube channel or something like that. Would there have to be like payments made and things like that? Is that how rights work when it comes to entertainment?
I guess it would be worth a question to some knowledgeable person. And I also am not 100% sure that I recall the details of it. Was Sting singing something that I wrote? Was I there in the same room with Sting? I honestly don't know, man.
So interesting.
Yeah, I guess, get your army of lawyers.
We'll get right on that.
Yeah.
Let's. I really am so excited that of what you're doing, and I thank you so much for all the things that you're sharing. I want to talk about the music that you're making. And by the way, for anybody who hasn't seen Steve Young on his social media platforms, whether it be the Facebook or the Instagram or the TikTok, you're putting out a lot of shorts. Music that is just so funny, and it's very, very in the sensibility of you, certainly, but those who enjoyed the sensibility of Late Show and Late Night, the echoes cannot be ignored. It's very much down the same path. I want to talk about that. So let's start the show off. Okay, if people want to follow you, where's the place to follow you?
I guess the main thing right now is Instagram, and I'm Pants Steve at Instagram. Oddly enough, and this is part of my brave new world, I am on TikTok now. Yeah. God help us all.
Yep.
I barely know any other people who are on TikTok, so my presence there is somewhat muted, but I'm putting my little bits there. That's Steve Young World on TikTok.
Yep.
And yeah, the whole thing with these little short bits, I've got longer, like, big songs beautifully produced with people in Nashville, but as I try to figure out how to put that stuff out, and that's a whole series of 100 cascading questions, I thought I can at least clear my throat by, like, I always have little ideas for songs and now these little videos based on just things I observe when I'm out for a walk or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I thought I can play guitar well enough, a pleasant amateur player for a living room setting. That's fine. I have like a decent phone that shoots video like everyone else in the world. Learned how to do a few things with editing. I thought there is no barrier to entry at all for me just putting this stuff up here, and it's low stakes. It's just 20 or 30 seconds at a time and just fun to do. And I want to be in the habit of doing that and not being too precious about any particular one. And apparently this is exactly the ethos of TikTok, which I have been skeptical of, but in theory, it's like, it's people just kind of putting it all out there in a very homemade way. And with the caveat that it shouldn't look terrible and shouldn't sound terrible, but
yeah,
it doesn't have to look like it was shot by a Hollywood studio to be appealing. So I thought, okay, well, maybe this is kind of my sweet spot after all. And I don't know if I'll ever be a big thing on TikTok, but my friends on Facebook and Instagram seem to be enjoying my little bits. So that's fun.
Yeah, there are times, and I'll tell you this, that I sing to myself, whether in my office or not, I'll start singing Dental School. And
If you've looked around the internet like I have, you've probably noticed there's just not enough content. Well, I'm going to do something about it. Here's a little song I wrote called Dental School. I went for a walk by the dental school. Only dentists can park there, and that's the rule. Dental school, dental school, dental school, dental school. Restricted parking by the dental school.
They're extremely clever but simple. You know, it's one of those things where you see it or you hear it and you're like, oh, I could have thought of that, but we wouldn't have thought of that because it comes from this mind that has this just this perspective. I just appreciate your perspective so much, and they're very funny. We're going to get into them. I'm going to insert a couple of the clips into this episode with your permission, of course. And please, everybody, follow Steve Young, follow everything that he is doing. You know, we know that we've beaten the bathtubs to death somewhat, but the bathtubs over Broadway, boy, does it just keep creating lives of its own for you. And I do want to talk a little bit about some of the things that you've been doing, some of the live shows you've been doing recently. The performer in you seems to be alive and well, as well as the archivist, as well as the writer. You seem to be kind of feeding all of these things here. You just had a really cool show in California.
Yes. So we have talked about bathtubs over Broadway before, the 2018 documentary made by Dava Wisenant that I'm the main subject of. And that continues to be out in the world on the various streaming platforms, but I'm trying to, you know, make a little money and have adventures by going places and doing shows where I get up on stage and talk about this other world of corporate show business that I found and show some clips and all that. The big one in California a couple of weeks ago was at the McCallum Theater in Palm Desert. And that one was over a year in the making. It was myself, but also six singers and dancers, very talented people. Some of them have been on Broadway. A terrific musical director, pianist, who was doing some of the music live. We had some orchestrations reconstructed from vintage songs that we had the singers and myself singing to. I did one song myself on guitar. There were amazing projections of album covers and moving elements and some film clips. And it was a lot to pull together on really a very short rehearsal schedule, and people had day jobs and couldn't get all in the same room at the same time very often. But as they say, we landed the plane. It was a little nerve-wracking, but heroic efforts by so many people. My co-writer and collaborator, Stuart Ross, a theater veteran, a guy named Wayne Bryan was the director. I met him in Wichita, Kansas, a few years ago when we were going around with Bathtubs Over Broadway. So, yes, somewhat to my surprise, I am getting more comfortable with being on a big stage in front of 800 people and saying, I'm going to take you on a journey tonight, and it's going to be crazy, and it's going to be hilarious, and it might just make a lump in your throat by the end.
Yep. Well, and very much like the movie, the same feelings, the same emotional trajectory and journey that you do take. That's a good word for it. Very cool. And the live audience is where you have screen. Has it been the same show every city that you've done, or are you kind of tweaking as you go and you're keeping elements that you know that you can, you know, bring self-sufficiently that doesn't necessarily require, like, or is it a show that's still kind of finding its voice and evolving? Or are they all just unique?
There are currently two versions of it. There's okay. The one main show where I'm just rolling into Chicago or Houston or whatever, and it's just me on stage,
yep,
talking and showing clips and doing a little bit of live music. And then there was this extravaganza, which does not bear a huge amount of resemblance to the one-man show. I was doing the one-man show before the pandemic, but since then I've found some wonderful new film clips and have updated it, and I am still tinkering with it. People get in touch with me and have treasures that they point me toward or give me. So I'm going to Chicago the end of this month for a couple days. I'm doing a show there. I may try out a couple new clips in Chicago. But the problem is they're so good that, oh, how can I not show this one? But I want to add this one. I have to not make it much more than an hour and a half. So it's a dilemma. Not a bad problem.
No, not at all. A plethora of material, and you just got to kind of, you know, trim the bonsai as to how things are going. How many dates can we? This episode's going to come out in about 2 weeks. So you know, we're at near mid February here, near the end of February. Any dates that we can plug here?
March 2nd in Chicago, so we may be too late for that.
Okay, but online we can do that. So March 2nd in Chicago, all
right.
Yeah.
Right. And actually March 1st, also in Chicago, I'm joining a friend's improv show and being a special guest and showing some clips there. And March 30th, I'm going to be in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, which is a lovely town I've been to many times for their film festival. And they're bringing me in. If people want to visit a charming Cape Cod, March 30th down there. And I will be trying to add more. I'm always looking for suggestions and ideas for cool artsy theaters and venues in different parts of the country. And if somebody says, oh my God, I bet blah, blah, blah theater would love this, I'm all ears. I'm always looking for those hot tips.
And it's funny because, you know, in some ways you are a one man show. You know, and when you're a one man show like that, you gotta kind of wear multiple hats. The business side of things, promotion, all of that sort of stuff, you've been thrown into that world. Are you looking at getting a little bit bigger when it comes to this stuff and the, you know, you're dipping your toe, as they say?
Yeah, I would like to. Right now, it's all been me just reaching out to theaters, and sometimes you get a lucky break and, oh yeah, we love Bathtubs Over Broadway, oh, we'd love to have you come in and do your show. Other times, if it's not an inquiry coming from a publicist and it's just in the slush pile, you may not you may not get any response. So in the long term, I'd like to have versions of this where some smart, experienced people are figuring out at least some of the business side of it. But we'll see if people think it has the legs to get big enough to justify that.
Well, it's incredible. It's certifiably a cult classic, Bathtubs Over Broadway, and the echoes of the amazing documentary. And I still want to have Dava on here to talk about it one day too, by the way. So I'm not done talking about this by far. I would definitely love to have Dava on here. It's masterfully done, and she did an absolute incredible job showing the artistry that she has, you know, behind the camera. Unbelievable. One of the books that Jeremy Weiner pulled out of that box, he pulled out a stack of books. One of the books he pulled out, of course, was Everything's Coming Up Prophets, which is your book. That is a spinoff from a Letterman bit, Dave's record collection. Are you still collecting? Have you gotten anything recently that you never had before?
From my own collection of industrial show records?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of what was the last piece of vinyl I got. I mean, this is the vinyl collection pretty much down here.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't look like much. This category is so tiny and narrow that can represent the best collection in the world, although there are a few other good advanced collectors now. I seem to get a lot of things now, like programs and tapes and bootleg video.
Yep.
People flow that stuff toward me here and there, so I like that. Vinyl is pretty hard to find new examples of now. I have like a want list with like 20 things on it that I know exist. At least one copy is known somewhere, but sometimes it's 20 years before I knock something off the want list.
Ah, that's the fun thing about collecting, though. And I appreciate that very, very much. Now, do you remember the first thing you ever performed on Late Show? The first song that you ever were a part of?
All the way back to 93, Rob Burnett and I wrote the Strong Guy, Fat Guy, Genius theme song.
Right. Yes. Yes. So you wrote that. You didn't perform it, though.
Correct. Yeah, I was Paul in the band, Will Lee doing the lead vocal, and it was always wonderful if you had some crude demo or foggy audio note about what you thought a song could be, and then you hand it to Paul, and then like 5 hours later, it's this bone crushing experience in a good way of like all this magnificent music and the threads and elements of the band are all coming together, and just like, that sounds legitimate from our dinky little song. That happened over and over again. I'd record a little demo in my office. Okay, Paul Schaefer, hey, Steve Young here, this little song, goes A, E, D, C, whatever, and you'd get down to rehearsal and you'd go, oh my God, that shouldn't be that good for me just goofing around upstairs, but there it is.
That, you know, you've just encapsulated one of the things that I think, might be the most understated parts of the show. Cause I mean, the show was so focused on Dave, the ultimate host in many ways. And I understand why his name's on the marquee, but the thing about it is the team that he assembled around him could do that at the highest level, whether it was musicians, writers, of course, but like editors, you know, special effects people, the people who would costumers, things like that, where they at a moment's notice could put something that was extremely high level into play. I'm really curious about you, though, and your music. The first memory I have is the Thanksgiving song of you actually being on camera, playing a guitar and singing something. Was that the first one?
I think that's the first time that I ever wrote a song with music and lyrics that I actually performed. I'd been taking guitar lessons for a number of years, I think starting around 2004.
Yep.
And after a few years, I was getting okay at finger picking. And part of me was just saying, oh, this is just the music side of things. My day job is the words and ideas. Those are two different spheres. And then slowly, it occurred to me, what if you did try to touch these two spheres together, your music and your guitar and your particular viewpoint with the words and ideas? And the Turkey Processing song was one of the very first times that I ever said, Let's see what happens if I wrote something with lyrics that I could play.
The reason I ask about that one in particular is because the sensibility of that song, very, of course, you know, in the voice of Late Show. And I think one of the reasons why I'm fascinated by you, like I think about the last time I was in your place and you were letting me listen to some of your current music, some of which I don't think has been released yet. And I can't wait to hear people's reaction to it. And there's one song in particular I was literally falling off your couch laughing from. And part of it was the echoes of Late Show. Like, it's a very similar sensibility. And your voice was very, very, very much that of Late Night and Late Show. And that song there, I think, going back to that Thanksgiving song, was probably, in my mind, you know, as important as it was for a show from an entertainment standpoint, it feels like that moment also sent you off on a trajectory that is being explored really, really deeply right now.
Yeah, and of course it is very intimately tied to all these years of the Letterman show and the development of certain mental muscles and creative muscles. And what I've come to realize about writing songs, whether they're 3 minutes long or 30 seconds long, so much of it is parallel to thinking of a bit for the Letterman show, where you say, all right, I have the idea, I have the core idea. What I need to do next is flesh it out with a couple good bits of development, musically, lyrically. But then the ghost of Dave is in my head saying, all right, I think we need to get out now. I think everyone's had enough. Get out, finish it, get out. So don't drag things on endlessly. The good compact, say it, have fun for 30 seconds or 2 minutes, and then get out. That is the way we tried to approach all the bits on the show. And it's also an excellent sort of template for doing anything like a song.
One of the things that you and I have talked about, and it came up in Jeremy's episode, and then it came up through, it was something through Joe. Joe had recorded, I don't know if it was a gift for the staff or whatever it was, but he had, similar to your calendar, recorded ambient sounds of the office place. Okay.
I just saw, I have that CD nearby, actually, the Day in the Life of a Late Show Writer, with a, here's the squeak of the door opening into the men's room. Here's the coffee maker. Here's the intern restocking soda.
The intern restocking soda. That word intern changes it too. That's fantastic. One of the things you and I have talked about, and that led to a conversation about one of the things you and I have talked about, and I'm curious if this is part of your songwriting process, and I know for a part of it, it is. The example that Jeremy and I talked about was, if you guys are doing a bit that was actual things heard on the subway, it has to be actual things heard on the subway. It can't be embellished. It can't be, let's use our creative minds to make up something that would be funny on the subway. You want to keep it as real as possible. And it was almost like, I don't know if they were written rules, but unwritten rules that many of you had. And it seems to be a similar kind of a vein you would go down as you're writing this music. Does that or rules like it exist?
There is something that I think I was ready to be a big believer in even before I met Dave or the show, but he was very much this sort of separation of church and state. There's some stuff that we make up and we acknowledge that, and then there's other stuff that's only fun if it's real and we didn't monkey with it. And if you contaminate that side of the real stuff with monkeying with it, it's disqualified. Right. And yeah, that's like dumb ads and supermarket finds and all that. They had to be real. That was just the only way to do it. Because if the audience started thinking, oh, I bet that's not real, then nobody's going to have a fun time on the show. But Conan O'Brien, I remember, on one of his very first shows ever, exploded that whole ethos with something called like real ads or something. And they were like ads in newspapers, but they were clearly all written by the writers and were 10 times over the top. But he just, with a straight face, continued to maintain, these are all real. And so I thought, that's a very brave postmodern step to take. That comedy nerds are going to like that. Will average viewers like it? Apparently enough average viewers are comedy nerds for a show like that, that it succeeded. But for us, there was a bright line of, yeah, real or not real. Like if I am on a walk and I notice that there's this NYU dental school and there's this long row of cars parked by it and they all have dentist plates because only dentists can park there, I didn't like go online and find other dentists' license plates to put in. They were all those cars really there. So I thought, well, that's the only reason it makes it fun is because that was real.
The I love that. And you have just done a really, really, we haven't talked about this on the show. Like we talk about process or process, depending if you're Canadian American. We talk about that, you know, all the time. But that's one thing that just had with all the writers we've had on the show, we haven't talked about that being a sensibility. But I'm so grateful you brought up the Conan example, because that's their sensibility. That's what they're doing here. The idea that part of the DNA of what made, you know, Letterman's production's point of view from the beginning was exactly what you just said there. And I mean, I guess you can't take that out of you. So again, you know, you've got a sign that where you know, the syllables of that sign fit perfectly of the saying on the sign fit perfectly into a melody that we all know. You know, that's parody or whatever, but it's just, again, it's a simple that you're not making up that sign to make up that thing, like maybe Weird Al might or something like that, just to use a, you know, a really broad comedy music example. It's something that's based on the genesis of it was something that inspired you from real life.
Yeah, and I don't think all my songs are going to be like that, but that particular one, I'd walked past these composting bins on the streets of New York City. I started seeing them last summer. I don't know how long they've been around, but it was like a list of things that could be in it. And one of the phrases was food soiled paper. And so I just started singing, food soiled paper, food soiled paper. I thought, well, that kind of works perfectly. And then I eventually thought, oh, well, this will be a good 30-second little song. You shoot a little bit of video and you'll sit there with your guitar. And now I'm adept enough that I can record decent sounding audio and then go in my walk-in closet and record a harmony track. So it sounds like the is it Sade? I think
Sade, yes, absolutely. Shout out to Sade.
So I've entered the Weird Al realm a little bit there, just on the basis of realizing subconsciously at first that food soiled paper fit exactly with smooth operator.
So what can go in this composting bin? Well, for example, food soiled paper. Food soiled paper. Food soiled paper. Plus food scraps and plant waste.
That's what I was going to ask. Was that immediately as you're seeing the sign? Was that later as you get home? Like when does that switch flip?
I think it was pretty instantaneous and not attempting to. It's just these things float past your field of vision and some algorithm trained by a lifetime just click, 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 click. Up, there it is. That's what song that fits with. I don't know if it's a useful talent, but it's a, I'm not sure it's even a talent. It may just be a weird mental tick.
Do you have a notepad that you carry with you, like stand-ups do, or do you have a note in your phone, a floating note that you just add little things
yeah,
to?
I've got a song lyrics note in my phone. I've got a miscellaneous notes thing. I've got always documents open on my computer desktop where I'm writing down possible bits for either the little songs. I've got like 15 documents open at all times with songs that that are in progress, or I've recorded the guitar but need to go and do the anyway. Yeah, it is a kind of playground for me now, and part of the appeal is I don't need to have a multi-million dollar corporation involved, like this barrier to entry thing. Like I was saying, anybody with average modern equipment can make something that sounds not terrible.
Yeah.
And for a lot of the kinds of little bits I'm doing, the short ones, not terrible is okay for now. So that's all I need for the moment.
And we'll talk to, you know, where we might see this going and in a minute here, but I want to talk about the creative part. There are some stand-ups, there are some comedy writers who I believe in structure. I need to write X amount of hours a day. Some who, you know, they literally kind of write as they go and they just evolve things kind of organically as they go through life. And they're kind of constantly working on these things. You know, you obviously had so much structure for so long, where your days, you know, the Groundhog Day effect, except everything being completely different, but some of that structure being very similar. Now, as you're doing this kind of as a creative entrepreneur almost, do you structure it at all? Or how do you get the creativity? Like, do you have times where there are like dry spells and then there are times where it's just a torrent where you can't even write fast enough? What's your process like these days?
I wish it was more organized. The Letterman show world was mostly a blessing because I got very good at just thinking it was normal to turn out a lot of stuff very quickly every day for weeks and years at a time. The downside was once those deadlines and expectations were taken away, sometimes it feels like I'm on a dark week that has lasted 8 years. And so it's reconstructing my own ways to be productive without these external forces. And some things work pretty well for a while. Like, I've written a few scripts, I've written a lot of songs, but it's curious to me, like, what gets me into the creative flow where 8 hours can go by like that and you don't realize, oh, the sun went down, did I forget to eat dinner? I love those times, and they rarely occur with anything now except writing and recording songs. Other stuff, if there's a deadline, okay, I'm doing this lecture at Northwestern University next week, and it's similar to one of my shows, but I know the date and time that's coming, and I got to be ready and have my ducks in a row with all my elements, so that will happen and it will be fine. But so that's an example of, okay, here comes the deadline. So that's its own thing. But for the many things that nobody in the world cares if I ever finish Project X, except me, how do I sit down and not look at the internet for 4 hours and just work? And I do think the internet era has shattered a lot of people's attention spans, and mine certainly among them. So that's maybe harder than it would have been a generation ago.
I got a piece of advice I'd like to offer you if I could. It'll make your life nice if you follow it like you should. Don't worry about perfection, cause the enemy is the perfect of the good. Is that how it goes? Don't worry about perfection, cause the enemy is the perfect of the good. Close enough.
Stephen Pressfield's The War of Art talks about that, the distraction, how distraction is like the enemy of creativity. And there have been times where, and I mean, you know, not telling any tales out of school, you and I sometimes will chat where I'm 3 hours behind you and I'm sitting here editing, I'm in the studio or whatever, and suddenly we start a conversation and it's like midnight my time, or you know, it's late, and I've wondered to myself, oh, I bet you Steve's been writing. I bet you Steve's been creating tonight and doing some things, which is why, you know, in the middle of the night, you're still up. Because when you're in that flow, for me personally, my flow was this. I love this so much. And my the job that's paid me up to this point is being a financial planner. I love connecting with people. That's the part of the job I love. The office work and all the other stuff that comes with it, I can kind of leave that. The thing that I know that I love, the kernel of me, is this. I love this. And I think that's why I love podcasting so much. When I meet a lot of creatives, whether it's stand-ups, whether it's writers, that flow state that you're talking about, that's kind of I don't want to put words in your mouth, but is that an optimal state for you? Is that the state that you kind of love to be in, where time doesn't matter and you're just, you know, whatever it is, whether it's good, bad, ugly. You just, do you love being in that flow state?
Yeah, because it means to me, number one, there is a horizon that I'm working toward. This song is going to be done today or tomorrow. It's not something that's going to be done in 5 years, and then I have to have 100 pitch meetings about it, and then it may never get off of my desktop. Like getting these little songs or medium-sized songs done, whether home recordings or in a real studio, seems so much easier and satisfying just because I know they can be done. And if you write a movie script, what are the chances that you're ever going to see a movie from it? And you know that I've written and acted in some short films, and that can be done if you're working on a small scale with just a few friends who you like to work with, like Deva and I have made a couple of short films. And so I know that can be done also, but I really treasure that feeling of, if I keep working on this, by this time tomorrow, I'll have something I'm really pleased with.
Is the, you know, you talk about you and Deva being, you know, incredible collaborators. You obviously were incredible collaborators with many of the writers on Late Show. Is this more of a lonely process? Like, I mean, you told me about one of the experiences down in Nashville. It seems to be that was a beautiful collaboration at that point. Is this a little bit more personal, a little less collaborative, or are you in your sweet spot when there is some collaboration going on? Like, do you ever see yourself taking on having a partner of some sort for this endeavor?
There's definitely been a lot of helpful people all along the way of this. My friend John Shane in Nashville has helped me get off the ground with the quote unquote real songs and getting them recorded. And he has notes on, like, I send him a demo and he says, I like this, but I wonder about that, or is there a way to make, and so I value all of that. It seems to me that usually the first phase of it is solitary, but then I'm hopefully wise enough now to say, I need fresh ears on this, and what don't people see in it, or that I think that is there, but it is not there after all. All those good things about smart people with good opinions, I'll take that definitely.
Do you know what the, is the plural of premises premisi? I don't know if that's...
No. Well, you just said premises, and I think that is it.
That's its own plural? Okay. Oh, premise and premises. Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Do you have a lot of...
There's a single premise, and then premises. There's a 1973 General Electric Sealants musical called Premises, Premises.
Outstanding. Do you have a lot of song premises sitting there? Like, do you have a whole list of little nuggets that haven't been polished off yet? Like the one I want to talk about more than anything is the German. I don't know if we can talk about the German one or not. But the premise of that one is just, that one there flattened me on my back laughing. And so I think it's a prime example of a premise that you come up with for some of these longer songs. And I'm just curious how many you have sitting in the hopper ready to be explored and lyriced out and kind of blown up and given the long form or the short form treatment, for example. Do you want to talk about maybe, can you talk about that song? Like, I don't know when you're ready to release that song or not, but.
Yeah, someday. I mean, that one is such an outlier musically and everything else, but that one is a comedy bit masquerading as a song, really. My friend John Shane, who I mentioned, has a couple of grown-up sons who are doing different things in the music business. One of them is quite involved in making beats and is very successful with working with internationally known hip-hop artists, and they use his beats. And when I heard this, I thought, beats, right. Wonder what I would do if I had a beat to play with. And I thought, I know really nothing about hip-hop, but I'm at this sort of magpie-like stage of my life where anything shiny that could be an element in some creative project, I'll just pick up and examine. And I asked John, would your son be willing to give me one of his beats to play with? And turned out, well, he's enough of a striving professional. He thought, all my stuff is going to my big gun collaborators, but there are millions of people selling beats on YouTube. And so I went on YouTube and looked around and downloaded something for a small price and used that as the sort of musical backdrop for this meditation about how I don't speak German, but I like to make up German sounding words like Blinderschankt and Strengthenprüfen. And then I started making up longer ones and giving the extremely arcane meanings of the German words that I was making up, which were all comedic little riffs. And my friend John in Nashville was so charmed by this. He said, oh, let me tinker with this. And he like mixed it and produced it to the point where it sounds like something. It's, I think, completely illegitimate as hip hop. It's completely illegitimate in any other kind of music. It's just this singularity that, yeah, I don't know. And it's unlike anything else I've ever worked on either. So I'm the guy who cannot stay in a lane. That may be my brand in the end, that I can't keep a hold of a brand. But yeah, so it was very encouraging to see you respond to some of these things, including the song You're Welcome, Germans.
I have bit my tongue with so many people about that because I've been wanting to keep the shield the privacy, but you shared that song with Irene and you shared it with me. And there have been so many times when she and I will just be on the phone and we will be laughing our asses off still to this day about that song and the lyrics. Any idea when and how that's going to be released? Or is this just part of the mystery that's unfolding for you right now of going, okay, yeah, what is the application? Here's some stuff. What's the application here? And is that what you're going through right now?
Yeah, it's a puzzle. I've got six songs that were done in some real Nashville sessions with ace musicians and like Grammy winning people involved.
Yeah.
And then, all right, so that's kind of its own batch. And then I've got these bizarre outliers like the Germans and a few other homemade things I've cooked up. And sometimes I've hired a drummer to like do a real drum track on something because I can kind of do my amateur job with a guitar now and maybe bass, but I'm not going to touch drums anytime soon. So I'm trying to figure out, do I put things out myself like via CD Baby? And those places will distribute all your stuff to Spotify and Apple and all that. You're out in the world, but do I need to find a sort of simpatico publicist who would say, oh my God, this is so fun, I've got to tell. Yes, and you'll pay me, but I also want to spread the word about your music. So I'm trying to talk to a couple people about things like that. And then there's the whole thing about record labels. And it seems like record labels only want you if you're already somebody with a million Instagram followers, which I'm not. Mm-hmm. But maybe some quirky labels run by people with certain sensibilities would like me and would get excited. So I'm in the long, slow, murky process of exploring all these questions. And I don't want it to be still up in the air when I'm 88 years old. I want to figure this out in the next few months. So again, just with the show venues, if anybody says, oh, I know the perfect music publicist who would love a Letterman-esque sense of humor, or a record label that has a certain odd flavor to it that might like some country-ish but weird and funny, or as you heard, some of it is country flavored, some of it's not. Again, can't stick to a lane, sorry.
I think it's better that you don't. I think it to me it's more charming and more fun when it just kind of hits you out of nowhere. Like again, and you're right, the German song certainly could have been on Letterman somehow, some way, or a version of that, could have been on that for sure. There's no question to me. Now that being said, I'm looking at things like Conan is doing with Sirius Satellite Radio and what there seems to be places where comedy, and I don't know if there's comedy music on that or not. I guess you're looking for somebody who might have ties into Sirius and things like that, right? Cause they seem to be paying money for things right now.
Yeah, I would, anybody with any interesting suggestion, and I barely know what questions to ask at this point. I feel right. So outside the music industry, I'm in a interesting songwriters group based in New York and try my songs out on people there. And people talk about strategies of how to get on Spotify and get the algorithm to notice you and all that.
Yeah.
So I'm at the edges of some of these conversations, but it does seem like a pretty tough time to try to be somebody in the music world who does it as anything more than a hobby. Because I was just reading about how some of the big companies now are doing well again in the music industry, but that's only because they've figured out how to monetize things with streaming platforms and Spotify and all that. But the artists themselves are not really making money off of that. So in the long term, I would be shocked if I got life-changing money out of my music. And so I just said, well, you're doing it because it's fun and satisfying. And if anything else ever happens, great. But don't go into it thinking, I better start planning which Mercedes to buy as soon as my album drops.
The folks, I know a few folks in the in the music industry, and one of the things that that they talk about is like, I think you're creating, I really honestly feel like you're creating a puzzle here, and you're just working on different parts of the puzzle all simultaneously. The folks that I know who are just they're just on the cusp of taking their music to the next level, like they're talking with Sirius right now, and their rep is or whatever it is, and that's going to take them to this and whatnot. But the one thing that they're sustaining themselves with is live performance. And if as you do this, I assume, and I mean maybe you've just fallen, you know, backwards into this, and they just happen to be evolving at the same time. But it's interesting to me that you are evolving relationships with venues, with an, building an audience, that sort of a thing. As at the same time, you're building this content, and you know, it seems like if the two merged, that's the simplest way for a musical act to get, to be sustainable, is to have people actually put butts in the seats and pay to see you, and go from there. Are you? Do you ever play any of this stuff on stage, or do you have a very serious line of demarcation between the live shows you do and the music that you're building?
Well, I mentioned how years ago it was, here's my guitar playing, which is instrumental, and here's my day job world of funny ideas. And I slowly, cautiously touched them together. I'm in the process of doing that, touching the two realms together right now. I have become pretty comfortable doing a few songs on stage live, like this 800 person audience in California. I did one song solo on guitar that went very well, but it was not a song of mine. It was a song written by Alan Sherman 50
Right.
something years ago.
Right.
And there have been other times I have been up on stage at a couple of venues a handful of times doing my own songs. And it's a little nerve-wracking, but it gets better the more you do it. So that's one of my goals for this year, is find more of these like open mic night for songwriters and just get comfortable and get practiced up on a good solid batch of my own material. So I feel like, yeah, in the same way that I love doing the industrial musical show now and I'm comfortable being that guy, if I could get that same kind of comfort, here's a batch of strange and surprising and funny songs and a few sincere ones, maybe. Again,
Sure.
hard to pick a lane and stay in it for me, but that is one of the goals, is to not just be a guy who sits in his living room and edits together audio files, but to actually get up in front of people and make it happen.
Sometimes stupid's all you need. Sometimes stupid's all you want. This time was one of those times.
You took the words out of my mouth. Okay, we'll get to Mule Deer in a second. I'm going to ask about Gary Mule Deer in a minute here, but you took the words right out of my mouth. One of the things I was going to ask was, you talk about these open mic nights, whatever. It seems to me that there's also a lane potentially, if you wanted to play with it, maybe perhaps a little more terrifying, the idea of stand up with this. Is that something that you've ever thought about, like going down to the cellar and trying some things out with some audiences and playing that way, and exploring this in that respect?
I have seen some stand-ups who do funny things and play a guitar and have some musical elements. I suppose it's possible that that could be somewhere in the future. It feels further away for me, partly because I still feel like quote unquote regular comedy feels like a more distant realm to me right now in terms of stand up. And there were years and years ago, I did do stand up a few times and it was kind of gratifying. But I feel like there's so much stand up out there. I think there must be that. Yeah, you'd probably need a very distinctive voice or gimmick or whatever. And I guess part of my gimmick could be, hey, look, I'm old. And part of my gimmick could be, yeah, I could play guitar. It'll be interesting to see if, like, something about comedy versus music, where that plane ends up tilting. So the long-winded answer is, I don't know. I mean, that's the short answer. The other one was the long-winded answer.
Okay, my friend, we've spent enough time together and I've seen you, you know, personally, and then of course in some social circles and whatnot. You certainly have a voice. You know, outside of the Ed Sullivan Theater after Rupert's thing, we chatted with a small group of people for about an hour, and you had us in stitches with the things that you were saying. Unorganized, of course, just throwing stuff out there, shooting the bull as we were doing. But you know, again, I still want to have, even if it's one episode, I don't care. I want to have a podcast called Three Comedy Writers Named Steve, where it's you, it's O'Donnell and Steve Weiner, all just at a table. And we throw out a couple little, you know, conversation pieces and just listen to the three of you go. That is hysterical to me. The stuff that just pops out of that, you do have a voice. So I that's a long-winded way of saying I've seen you enough to know you have a voice. First off, you have a very distinct, again, I don't know if it is a mighty, mighty baritone or what it is, but I don't know these things, but you've got that, the voice itself, the deadpan is perfect. You've of course got the sensibility, and then you've got this musical talent too. To me, there's a stand-up act there. Whether it's worth exploring, I don't know. I want to ask about Gary Mule Deer. Did you ever meet Gary when he came on the show at all? Do you remember Gary at all?
I do remember him. I cannot summon much about him. Was he the one with the red sweater, or was that Mort Saal?
No. No, Gary was the guitar with the bow and arrow. And he would come on and he was more spastic, obviously, in his style, but he would go and he'd start playing a song, and it was a comedy song, and he would do a little bit. I highly recommend, by the way, for everybody out there, he's an old friend of Dave's. He was from the Comedy Store days, but, you know, touring comedian, and very much musical with comedy at the same time, and just phenomenal, phenomenal mind. The Gary Mule Deer documentary just came out. I highly recommend it to everybody. And also, we're going to throw a shout out. Gary's, you know, he's not doing the best as he could be medically. And so we're going to shout him out. But I look at a guy like that who toured for a long time but then he ended up at the Grand Ole Opry, and he found an audience who absolutely loved exactly the synergy that you're talking about, the comedy and the music all together. That could get a lump in your throat. That could bring up emotion. That could, you know, and I don't know if that's that Southern or that Midwestern kind of charm, but this to me, it feels like it has similar things. It feels like you have a one man show that could be pretty special, man. That's what I see when I see this.
How can it be that it's 53 years since the celebration? Seems like yesterday. How did time slip away from the National Industrial Cafeteria Managers Association?
Thank you for that. encouragement and the reference. Sometimes people say, well, you have to be able to say what your comparables are. Who are you like if we wanted to talk to somebody in the business? And I say, I don't know. And sometimes I think, well, Flight of the Conchords, I've seen some of that, and they've got some funny songs that are just like two guys playing guitars, and I'm one guy playing one guitar. But something seemed in the same universe there sometimes. So I struggle to find comparables. I suspect that 27-year-old record executives are going to be less excited about the Gary Muledier reference, but...
I think you're right. Yeah. That being said, I mean, you know, you got something, and it is unique, and it is its own thing. And I will support it to no end as much as I possibly can. It's so good. Do you have a YouTube channel that you throw stuff up on?
I do. There's steveyoungworld.com, which I've not put too many things on, although there are two songs of mine up there right now. You may remember one called Look at All the People.
Yep.
Does that one ring a bell? Yeah. Yep. So once in a while I've made something where I've actually made my own video for a 2 or 3 minute song.
That's the underwear song, right?
That's right. Yes. Okay, one a couple years earlier about New Year's resolutions. And that one has extremely minimal video, but those are kind of warning shots to the world of what might be coming. Although that Nashville stuff is a far bigger deal in terms of production value.
Yeah, there's the one song where the guitar in that song, the speed finger picking guitar in that it's I don't even know the style that you call it. It's a country, almost a bluegrass type that is just absolutely spectacular. I forget the artist that you told me the name of the artist who performed it, but it was just unbelievable. That's
probably the song called Fitted Sheet, in which there is a absolutely genius guitar player named Trey Hensley.
There you go. Yep.
In Nashville, who did a little studio session and just machine gunned crazy country Telecaster guitar all over the top of this thing. Is just wow. Okay.
So good. Well, I appreciate it, and everything that we can do to support you in this, we will do. Steve Young World, and as I'm allowed to throw stuff out there, please do send me stuff that I can throw out there. I assume all the stuff that's out, the shorts, you know, and after we finish this or whatever, I'll make sure that I have all the ones, and I want to include them in this episode. And anything else that I can throw out there, I will throw it out immediately. And it would be, it'd be so cool to see a following start to build for this. And I know endlessly gratifying for you, that the audience would be found, because there is one, obviously. I mean, it just, we need to crack that code. Let's go back to the world of Dave for a second here. Have you kept up with anything? Did you see when Dave was on Colbert when he came back to the
I didn't, I don't know. I was never a great consumer of late night media, even when I was in it. Mm-hmm. So I was noting that he was on, and it was historic, and it was his first time back at the theater, but I have not watched it.
So that being said, like, and that's one of the things that I find so charming about you, you know, famously or infamously, I guess. I mean, you know, for the comedy nerds out there, the Letterman nerds, Steve Young's hired for the job, and people are talking about Calvert. And you don't know who Calvert was. I love that. That's so charming to me, because it shows that while you do have a very similar sensibility and humor wise, you also brought in a crazy amount of freshness to it. And that's probably part of the secret sauce as to why you were so successful and revered with the show as long as you were, because you did have that fresh perspective. You didn't consume everything. But the reason I'm asking about that is, was Rupert's get together the first time you went back to the theater? Was that the first time you were back in the lobby? Because there's a lot of folks that was the first time that they were there since the show closed off.
I had only been back to the building a couple of times since, I guess, the summer of 2015. Things were still winding down, and I was back a couple times. But Colbert's first week on the air in September of 2015, my friend Cheryl, who you may know, Cheryl Levin Brown, part of the Alt
say,
Dan
yeah.
Letterman. Yeah.
Yep.
She got tickets to the, I think it was the Friday show of the first week of Colbert at the Ed Sullivan Theater, and said, "Do you want to go?" And I said, "Well, I am interested, but please be aware of a couple of things. It's going to be interesting but weird for me to just go into this place. But also, when I'm sitting at the show, you know, the comedy damage, I'll probably just nod politely at the comedy, and I will not be a satisfying audience member laughing like I should be, because we've talked about that, I'm sure. Yeah. Just I can say, yep, that works, but it's rare to make me laugh. But I did laugh a couple of times, but they were at the wrong things, like during a commercial when it's this otherworldly version of the theater and the show, and nothing's the same. Except then during a commercial, Pat Farmer, the stagehand, walks out, and I go, well, that's hilarious right there.
Yep, I get it.
And one other time I was back, a friend of mine who was working in some capacity at the Colbert show a couple of years later said, oh, if you ever want to come in and just look around the office. And I said, oh, yeah, I kind of am curious about that. And the offices had, of course, been completely renovated.
Yep.
And walking down hallways, you were kind of at sea. Like, I think I know where I am because this hallway probably can't have changed, but everything else, all the, like this wall was knocked down, and this is a little pantry area where the hipsters have their cold cereal dispensers and yogurts and organic things. And then this room is different, and that room. That must have been my office, because that view out the window is my view, but everything is different. And then I went into the 14th floor men's room. That had not been touched at all. That was like,
oh, wow.
The one zone that was like the unbreached Tutankhamun's tomb that had never been destroyed by grave robbers. And that was eerie, because that 100% the same. But then after that, I think it had been years and years since I was back before the Rupert thing.
Okay. So the night of the Rupert thing, it was fascinating to me watching, because like Dave, many of the staffers, the last time he was at that theater was before, you know, the show was closed up shop forever. And it was his first time back. And I mean, you know, I think, I don't know if it's loyalty. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's PTSD, whatever, but a lot of them had stayed away and wouldn't go in. But one of the things that is fairly untouched is the lobby and the, you know, the restroom going downstairs where the production is. And much of that is nearly identical, maybe a fresh coat of paint or whatever, but very, very similar. And it was fascinating watching you and many of your contemporaries. Like at one point there was, we were bringing in drinks from the deli because it was Rupert's retirement, and he emptied out the cooler because the Hello Deli was, you know, closing up. So he, you know, donated the drinks for the event. And so the best way to get to the deli from where we were is taking a shortcut through the theater. And boy, was it crazy watching some of the staffers go like go from this really familiar place to a place that was totally foreign. And the feelings that were expressed that night were really, really interesting. I'm super curious about your perspective of being in that foyer again in that night. And if there was any, I don't know if it's therapeutic or if it's, just memories being jogged, anything like that. Was it weird for you to be in there that night?
A little bit. I don't think I even peeked into the theater itself. Maybe I did, but I knew from the 2015 visit that it would not look inside like I remembered it. But I do remember that time I went to the September 2015 Colbert show and being in the queue of people snaking through the lobby. And the lobby was, as you say, completely familiar and really not touched at all, to the point where I thought, oh, I wonder if I have a minute to run down to the tape room and say hi to Randy and then say hi to people. Oh, wait. None of those people are downstairs now.
Yeah.
It seems like they're all got to be there eternally. How could anything be different? And then you have to make an intellectual effort to say that is not down there anymore. None of my office is upstairs anymore. None of my things are still there anymore.
Yeah. A lot of laughter that night of Rupert's retirement. Fun experience for you, I assume so. I mean, we
Yeah.
hung out afterwards for that hour after we all got kicked out. We hung out for an hour shooting the bull on the under the marquee.
It was a like a very weird but wonderful high school reunion.
It was an honor to have been there and to be, yeah, it was surreal to have been a part of it. Might be the last staff photo ever taken too, which was weird. Do you have a copy? If you don't have a copy of that photo, I'll make sure I send it to you. But there's the staff photo with everybody there, in that foyer too. It was just a really cool thing. Dave appeared on Strike Force 5, the podcast that all five of the current Late Show hosts, or late night hosts, I should say, put together during the strike. And Dave appeared on that episode. He talked about how when he went back to 30 Rock's studio, and he just looked at what Fallon and company had done and what it looked like there. It's and Seth and them had done, and that, like, you know, he's like, I love the linoleum. Like, it's just such a neat place. He had a very similar reaction to going back to the theater for the first time too. He's like, it's like a mall in here. Completely different. But I just found it interesting that so many of you hadn't been back to the theater, and I wanted to ask you about
Yeah.
that feeling.
When I worked on Maya and Marty, the NBC variety show in 2016, that was at 30 Rock. And in fact, it was in studio 6A or whatever the old late night world was. So that was eerie to be back there. It was being rebuilt and reconfigured for this new show. Didn't have too many emotional cues about the Letterman-esque past. Even the hallways had been refurbished. Once in a while, you'd get to some Rockefeller Plaza elevator landing and go, oh, right, I remember this kind of marbled stone here and this chrome thing. One time, I tried to go up to the old Letterman offices on the 14th floor of the west part of the building. And I got up to the 14th floor on the elevator, and I was faced with this sort of glass enclosed modern office zone that was so disorienting. I thought it's not going to be worth it to go in there. Zero is going to recall to mind anything about my past. It's completely redone, so I didn't go look.
I can understand that. But then you talk about, like, when you were talking about your old office, at the office building, there's your view, you know, there's the window where Meg was across the way. Meg Parson was across the way there, or whatever. And that's really the only thing that's similar, but those eerie little teeny tiny echoes. I can't thank you enough for coming on here again. And I want to do this as many times as we possibly can. I know we're going to have an episode with O'Donnell at some point. Speaking of which, is wanting to be a prof, is wanting to teach, take some of these amazing things that you have learned and sensibilities that you have. You know, he's done his thing at NYU. Is that something that you would enjoy doing?
I did do a class at NYU for several years about TV history. And I don't know if
Oh.
we talked about that, where I, being an indifferent consumer of television for much of my life, had to panic and race to catch up on in order to talk about some of these shows. I had never watched the Mary Tyler Moore show. I'd never watched the Dick Van Dyke show, and 10 other things that it is assumed that I am knowledgeable about backwards and forwards that I had just never watched. So there's the huge amount of imposter factor for that. I ended up feeling like I did okay on that. Comedy writing, I also feel like, well, no 20-year-old wants to hear from me. Although apparently O'Donnell has carved a very genial and effective presence in that world. I don't know if I'm that kind of teacher. I'm almost a little bit professorial in some aspects of my show, where I'm talking about this hidden secret world of 20th century business culture and entertainment. I don't know if there'll ever be an academic setting for that or not. Although as I did mention, I'm doing a presentation at Northwestern in a week, and that will be similar to my regular show, but tilted a little more towards sort of academic or pseudo academic observations.
So you do take speaking gigs as well.
Oh, yes, I did a keynote address to a group in Kansas in the fall. That was exciting. That was a new experience. And you're just supposed to try to say yes to things, even if you're a little nervous or you're unprepared or not the right person, but you find your way. And that ended up being very successful. So, yeah, all varieties of these shows and speaking engagements, I am up for.
If people want to get a hold of you for that, what's the best way to do that? Social media?
I'm sorry, through what?
Social media, is that the best way to get a
Yeah,
hold of you
well,
if somebody wants to book you?
there's I will reveal my email address if it's safe. Pantsteve@gmail.com if people want to find me about coming somewhere and having an adventure.
Yeah, I think again, I see how all these things can converge with each other. I mean, it feels like it. I know I'm endlessly fascinated when you start talking. I also feel like I'm sitting under a learning tree. I think you, but again, you also have that sensibility that so many of the people did who worked for that show for so long. You also very self-deprecating and don't necessarily the imposter syndrome thing. Just again, I can relate to it because I felt it. I felt it with this show. It's slowly kind of going away. So I 100% understand where you're coming from,
Yeah, you're
but
way too cocky now. You're
I know.
such a diva.
But from me to you, I find it baffling, and I think it's a really beautiful message about humanity and how we're wired. I find it baffling that you could feel imposter syndrome because I do look at you and it's like I hang off your every word. If you did teach a comedy class, I would want to take it, because the depth of experience that you've had is absolutely tremendous. It's so fun to see you still creating, and thank you for being a friend of the Letterman podcast. That's something we've adopted and we've taken, shamelessly ripped off of Late Show, a friend of the show. We use that. Thank you for being a friend of the show. But I got to tell you, publicly and proudly, I am so grateful to be your friend. Thank you so much for everything that you have done, in front of the cameras. This is your third appearance here, and but of course behind the scenes and things like that. Steve, I love you, man, and I appreciate you very, very much.
Oh, well, thank you. Now we've gone from the funny stuff to the lump in the throat stuff.
Little bit of lump in the throat, a little bit
Yeah.
awkward, so we won't spend very long on it. Okay, so those who have the opportunity to go see Steve live, go see him. What can we plug? Bathtubs Over Broadway. If you haven't seen it, go buy it. Go to the iTunes and actually buy the thing. It's not that expensive, and stream it if you gotta, but buy it if you can. And again, let's get Dave on here too to talk about it as well. This thing has a life of its own. It is a certified cult classic, and let's grow the cult and see what happens. And maybe we can get a commune somewhere. That'd be a lot of fun.
Oh, we can dig. Okay, cults and communes. Got it.
I'll do a really quick outro and we could say our goodbye privately if that's all right with you.
Okay.
All right. Boy, oh boy. I could never not be endlessly delighted by Steve Young and his antics and his creative endeavors. And I'm so grateful that we can share them here on the Letterman podcast. It's an absolute honor to be a vessel. Is that what I am? I don't know. Whatever this is, a vessel for this. Oh, go ahead. Yes, sir.
When we were talking about some of my earlier songwriting,
Yeah.
I think you're a fan of this, but I had that Super Bowl history song that's still floating around on YouTube and the Letterman channel and all that. That was a probably a watershed moment where you can realize you can take a stupid idea and burnish it up so it's right on the line between stupid and clever and make something of it.
I V, and then there's V, right? Is that I think that's it. I might
Yep,
have
the
got the numerals
long.
wrong, but that's the tune. It's incredible. I post it every year at Super Bowl. The Super Bowl song, From the Mind of Steve Young, prime example of something where it's like an eye roll at first when you realize what it is, and then it starts to get catchy, and then it comes back around and becomes hilarious at the end. Amazing that you can predict that. Yes, absolutely. And if you go on the Letterman Podcast Facebook group, you will see that recently because the Super Bowl just recently happened. So we've shared it and we will continually share it as well. Yeah, absolutely. That's another, again, perfect example of the voice of the show. And if you like that song, and think that that's funny, that perfectly encapsulates what you get when you listen to Steve's current stuff. The bridge is built, everybody. We just need to start crossing it and find ways to cross it. That's clearly happening. So, that's been another episode of the Letterman Podcast with Mike Chisholm. Coincidentally, I am Mike Chisholm. Thank you and good night.
There's someone I'd like you to meet. It's my favorite wind-up toy. Watch this. I think it's some kind of metaphor or a defective unit.
Overcoat and underpants.